Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On a cool January morning, the killer executed Assistant District Attorney Mark Haas in broad daylight. 8 shots fired a block from the Kaufman County Courthouse. 2 months later, a massacre. The day before Easter, the couple slept, bunnies, eggs, a flower centerpiece gracing the table. Death rang their doorbell and filled the air with the sound of an assault weapon discharging round after round into their bodies. Eric Williams and his wife Kim celebrated the murders with grilled steaks. Their crimes covered front pages around the world, many saying the killer placed a target square on the back of law enforcement. Williams planned to exact revenge on all those who had wronged him, one at a time. Throughout the spring of 2013, Williams sowed terror through a small Texas town, and a quest for vengeance turned to deadly obsession. His intention? To keep killing until someone found a way to stop him. The book they're featuring this evening is In Plain Sight, The Kaufman County Prosecutor's Murders, with my special guest, journalist and author, Catherine Casey. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Catherine Casey.
Glad to be here, Dan. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. This is, as I mentioned to you just before we got on, one really exciting book. Edge of your seat, page turner. I know those are cliches, folks, but this is incredible. And let's get right to this incredible story. Now, we start, and you start with the book, where we really get a really detailed background on how this incredible disaster came to be. From promising people and careers and a small little community in Kaufman County. Let's first talk a little bit about Kaufman County before we start talking about the early life of our main character, Eric Williams.
Well, Kaufman is kind of a sleepy little town, and it's the county seat. The courthouse is kind of an undistinguished building in the center of it. And it's surrounded by a town square with old storefronts. And it's kind of a quiet little place, but it's on the outskirts of Dallas. And it's the kind of place where people have, families have been there for generations. There are cattle ranches surrounding Kaufman proper. It's the kind of place where Aunt Bee in the old Mayberry series might be seen walking down the street carrying one of her pies to a neighbor's house. It's sure. Not the kind of place where you would think people would be gunned down in the street.
Now, you talk about Eric Williams and not such a spectacular or eventful early life, but would you talk about high school and some of the oddness is noted by people? So tell us a little bit about some of the oddness at high school. You mentioned a briefcase. And really what his character is known for by people in that little community. What do they see, and what are the first things that he does at high school towards his dreams?
Well, Eric really wanted to go into the military, and he was really geared toward that mindset. He was very bright. Eric Williams is a very smart man. He was one of the brainy kids in high school, and he was a little quirky. Instead of talking to the other kids on the school bus, he'd sit and he'd read a book. He carried a briefcase, which is unusual in a small town for a kid to do. I think it's actually unusual any place, but especially in a little Texas town. And he was a Eagle Scout. He was really well thought of. But people did notice that he was a little odd. Like when he took his Eagle Scout exam, he was asked some questions, and the man who asked him the questions, the scoutmaster, noticed that when Eric couldn't answer a question, his eyes just got kind of dark and dead. And the guy thought there's really something wrong here, but he didn't know what it was. And then he was off to college, and it was just, it continued like that. People have told me that in high school, Eric and his group of friends, he had a really tight group of friends that he played games with, like Dungeons and Dragons, where they took on roles of fictional fantasy characters. He played Star Trek, and they played different characters from Star Trek. And he was really into that. That was his life. And I've heard it referred to as being a little bit like the popular show on TV, The Big Bang Theory.
Right, right. You talked about, too, that he was very intelligent and he had got a chemistry scholarship at Texas Christian University. And but then he had joined ROTC and he focused on law enforcement. Tell us how he progresses in his interests for military and that how that changes his direction in education.
Well, he really did want to be a soldier. Eric really wanted to be a career Army. But the Army was at a downsizing point when he was graduating from TCU, and he wasn't picked up. A lot of his friends were. And Eric had always been this kid who was, you know, everybody talked about how smart he was, how great he was. And this was like the first failure, Dan. I mean, this was a really sad one for him. So he enrolled in he joined another group of, like a voluntary military organization. And then he went into law enforcement, and he was, after college, He started getting jobs working for small police departments in and around the Fort Worth area where he was living at that time.
You talk about those early jobs. You say that certainly there was a disappointment in him not having a future in the military. He realized that. So he applied to small police forces in Fort Worth, Texas. And you talk about a suburb called White Settlement. What was the situation that he left both of those police departments?
Well, he was fired from both. And this wasn't something people expected of Eric Williams. Eric was gung-ho, and Eric was going to be a success. And the first department he was let go after he asked to have time off to take a college class, and he was denied it, and then he called in sick and just didn't show up for work to go to the class. But the second one was more troubling. One evening, Eric and another police officer, instead of circulating through town as they were supposed to be, this is a small Texas town, checking on residents, didn't do that, and it's thought that they went to a topless bar, and instead Eric hacked into the fourth level of the computer system at the police office, which was the most secure, and changed his report to show that he had been in town circulating that night. The police chief got a call that night reporting it and showed up the next morning, looked at the proof and confronted Eric. Eric denied it, and he fired Eric, and at the time, the police chief thought that the whole thing was very odd because obviously Eric was very well schooled in how to hack into the computer, and he thought he should have been able to cover his footprints if he'd wanted to, and the police chief thought it was almost as if Eric was thumbing his nose at them, that he wanted them to know that he'd been able to hack into the computer system and do what he wanted with it.
Now, you talk about in November 93, at 26 years of age, Eric moves with his friend Paul Lilly to Kaufman County, which you say is about 40 minutes southeast of Dallas. And his friend Lilly got a job at the sheriff's office, and they lived in Terrell. And Eric began studying for a law school entrance exam So tell us what he does in terms of, he needs money, so what happens and who does he meet?
Well, Eric went into Kaufman looking for work, and word got to the county judge that there was this promising young man who'd been an Eagle Scout, who'd been in law enforcement, who was looking into law school, who was looking for work in the area. And the county judge called him in, and his name is Ashworth, Glenn Ashworth, and interviewed him. And Eric was very impressive. He, you know, he looked on paper, he looked very good. And the judge needed a new county clerk, a clerk for his office. The clerks act as kind of an assistant. They do the scheduling. They're kind of the gatekeepers for the judges. They do a lot of the paperwork. He sat down, talked to Eric, and he hired him. Glenn Ashworth, at that point, was the only state-level judge in Kaufman County, Texas, and he wielded a substantial amount of power in that little community. And with that hire, Eric became aligned with one of the most powerful men in Kaufman County.
You also talk about all of the, as you mentioned, all the things that he oversaw for the judge as a court coordinator, and he wielded a lot of power just in that role. But also what Judge Ashworth suggested Eric do was register as an unpaid reserve officer with the DA office. And once he did that, what did that enable Eric to do, which was very important to Eric?
He was able to keep his gun with him to go through security and into the courthouse and even into the courtroom. The judge wanted him to have it. I mean, it's one of those things. A lot of the bailiffs are there and they're armed, and we all have metal detectors now at the entrances of the courthouses, and this was another level of security. So Eric liked this. He started doing some things part-time with the sheriff's department. He became kind of an active volunteer.
You also talk about that first summer, though, that there's a little, well, not a little, an incident that, in hindsight, forebode things to happen in the future. But that first summer, he attended a court coordinator's conference, and he met a woman named Janice Gray. What happened that summer with Janice Gray?
They started dating. Eric hadn't dated a lot of girls, but he'd had a few girlfriends over the years, and he liked Janice. Janice liked him initially. She thought he was just this great guy, you know, a little quirky, kind of funny, you know, but seemed like a really sweet guy. And they dated for a while, talked on the phone, got together. Even though they lived in separate counties, they lived quite a distance apart. And then Janice found somebody she really, really was attracted to, really cared for, and saw a future with, and she broke it off. She thought that Eric took it well, but then they showed up at the court coordinator's conference that next year, and Eric came up to her and showed her a gun in the lobby of the hotel that they were staying at, and then said that he brought it to give to her son. Janice didn't want it. It kind of gave her an odd feeling. But later that night, and he wanted to go out to dinner, but she refused. Later that evening, she showed up with friends at a restaurant bar, and Eric was suddenly there again, standing right beside her, and he pulled the gun out and showed it to her. He pulled her away from her friends, and then showed her the gun and said, I don't have anything to lose. Her friend saw this happen and came over and got her and walked off with her, and they reported it to the police. The police couldn't find Eric, but when they got into the conference next morning, there he was, sitting in the conference room as if nothing had happened. The police took him away and brought him to the courthouse. Janice was filing charges, and the police talked to the district attorney in Kaufman, who talked to Judge Ashworth. Judge Ashworth, who assumed, and probably not unsurprisingly so, just thought that his young coordinator had done something foolish, had too much to drink and done something foolish, took responsibility for him and had him brought back to Kaufman. And Janice agreed not to go forward with anything as long as Eric left her alone.
Yeah, amazing. In the fall of 95, you write that at 25 years of age, he began law school in Fort Worth, and his future seemed really bright. And that Judge Ashworth and Eric became increasingly closer. Tell us a little bit about this developing relationship between the two. How far did it really go, and how close did they become?
You know, they were really good friends. They went out to, the judge included Eric in pretty much most of the things that he did. Eric was invited into the judge's home for different events when he had parties. They had lunch together every day, along with a couple of other people in Kaufman, people from the courthouse and the county surveyor. They liked Eric. The judge really liked Eric, thought he was funny. Eric did a good job for him. Judge Ashworth was proud of the fact that Eric was going to law school and bettering his future. It got to the point where they became such good friends at one point that the judge actually included Eric as a beneficiary in his will. He just saw Eric as this really great kid, and he was trying to help him start. He was acting as his mentor, and he obviously saw Eric as his protege, and he was proud of him. And when Eric did so well in law school and then graduated from law school, Eric actually gave the judge a plaque thanking him for what he had done for him. People in Kaufman saw the two of them as just very close friends.
You say at that odd time, and you include, though, that, again, he was accepted as a quirky guy with this odd smile, and his behavior is just accepted. Overall, they've considered him a nice guy. But you include this odd statement about if he... If he ever decided to go out, what did he say, and in the context of how did he come up with this statement, which people thought was odd?
Eric said odd things at times. You know, he was one of those guys who sat there and kind of had a little smile on his face, and people weren't sure what he was thinking. And at times he'd blurt out strange things. And there'd been a shooting someplace in the country that was in the news. And sitting at lunch one day with a group of friends, Eric said, if I ever go out, I'm going to take a bunch of people. If I ever decide to go out, I'm going to take a bunch of people with me. And no one knew quite what to think of it, you know? I mean, it's such an odd thing to say. They knew Eric. They liked Eric. Eric's a friend. They didn't think Eric would really do that. Why would Eric really do that? So they kind of looked at each other, and then one remarked to the other when they were leaving that Charles Whitman, who shot from the UT Tower in the 1960s, was an Eagle Scout like Eric, and somebody wondered if one day Eric would shoot people from the roof of the Kaufman County Courthouse.
Wow. You talk about that in 96 he was on online message board and he met someone. Tell us who he meets and a little bit about Kim Johnson's early background.
Kim was working at that point at a doctor's office. She was kind of a medical receptionist. She'd done very well in high school, smart, pretty, big blonde Texas hair, a great laugh. People liked Kim. She'd gone to college. She went to SMU, decided to drop out, and was working for a doctor at that point. Kim, on the surface, looked kind of like just a happy-go-lucky girl. The truth was that her home life had been pretty traumatic. Her father, she describes her father as having been abusive over the years, and the family home had not been as happy as people, you know, as Kim portrayed it from the outside. So she was somebody who had kind of this undercurrent of tension in her life growing up, and she was looking for somebody kind of like Eric. The guys she dated, she decided, were too, laid back, and they weren't the kind of guys she wanted to be with. And Eric was fun, and he was smart, and she was really attracted by his intelligence. And Kim is a smart woman. And they kind of saw in each other something, and in no time at all, Eric was, you know, they met online, and then they met in person, and they spent time together, and they fell in love.
You say shortly after, this union really seemed to change Eric around the office, and his character almost seemed to change, including some things in behavior where he lost weight, seemed to get healthier. Tell us a little bit about some of the positive changes that seemed to happen once he met Kim.
Well, Eric's friends were a little worried about this relationship in the beginning. You know, people who meet on the Internet, especially back then, a lot of people do it nowadays, but back then this was all pretty new, and people were concerned about who Kim was and you know, whether or not she'd be good for Eric. But Eric's friends saw that he was happier. He seemed more content in his life. He was really proud of Kim. He carried a picture of her in his wallet, had a picture of her on his desk, talked to people about, you know, how beautiful she was. And he just seemed to be opening up to life. He did. He looked healthier. Life looked really promising. He was finishing law school. The future was ahead. Everything looked really good for Eric Williams.
Now, you talk about that he lost weight, but that at the same time, this story has got a lot of people with not good health. So what does he discover in terms of his own health soon after meeting Kim?
Well, they had some bad turn of events. Shortly after they married, Eric found out he started losing weight. He started having to rush to the restroom all the time. It turned out that he had type 1 diabetes. And this was something that really changed his life in many ways. He had continued to be a volunteer in the armed services and at that point had to tender his resignation because he knew he could never be called up for active duty. And things hadn't really gone very well for Eric at that point. I mean, his life was opening up for him. His legal degree was, you know, he was getting to the point where he was graduating, but he'd had all of those disappointments. The military thing hadn't worked out. The law enforcement thing, he'd been fired at the jobs that he'd had. And now this, you know, now this health thing. And then Kim got some bad news. It turned out that she developed a lump on her leg, and she was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. So both of these young people at the beginning of their lives together, you know, all of a sudden their lives are turned around.
You talk about Becky Calabria, and they owned a little law office, and Becky Calabria was one of the people that went for lunch routinely with Judge Ashworth and Eric. And so when, in 1998, he starts working with these people. Tell us what happens at this law office.
Well, at the law office, Eric signed on right after he got his law degree, as he said, and the intention was that he would work and that a percentage of whatever he earned would go toward the law firm. But, Eric was a known quantity in Kaufman County, and so he immediately started getting court appointments. And he was a good friend of the judge handing out the appointments, not that he was getting really special treatment from Judge Ashworth, but he got his fair share of the cases. And they started, his calendar started to fill up, the money started to come in, and Eric wasn't paying Becky Calabria what she had thought she had expected he would be paying. So there were some words that passed between the two of them, and Eric describes it as a misunderstanding over the wages, but he left. And he hung out his own shingle right across from the county courthouse and opened his own office.
You talk about the really good money that flowed in from Eric's court appointments, and In 2001, they bought almost a 2,900-square-foot, three-bedroom house about a mile and a half from the courthouse at 1600 Overlook with a three-car garage. Tell us how close Judge Ashworth was with him, literally.
Judge Ashworth was right across the field at the back of at Eric and Kim's new house. He had a place that was directly across. That whole area, Kaufman is kind of an incubator. A lot of little towns are, but the area that the Williams has bought in was actually developed by one of the judge's cousins. And the house that Eric and Kim bought was once owned by a member of the judge's family. It was all very close.
You talk about Eric at this point indulges his interests. At the courthouse, he shows off firearms and at least you say 10 or so handguns and rifles. What was the word around town about his weaponry? But you say, why was that not a concern?
Well, Eric had always, when Eric and Kim married, he had about 10 guns, 10 firearms. And once the money started coming in, he was buying more. And he was showing them to people at the courthouse, letting them hold them. He was really proud of the guns, the rifles. He bought some AR weapons. He was really into this. And word started floating around the courthouse that Eric had an arsenal, a small arsenal in the closet at his office. People didn't think a lot about it because this is rural Texas, and most people in rural Texas have guns. So it was something that people noted. It was something that they knew about Eric, but it didn't foster any major concern.
You talk about the political climate in this town changing, and in 2002, Judge Ashworth is a Democrat facing re-election in a county that's turning conservative. Tell us what happens as a result, and what is this effect, what does this change in Eric's life?
Well, Judge Ashworth decides not to run again. A lot of Texas judges do this. They step down at a certain point after they've got all their years in, and they start working on the side as visiting judges, and they take life a little bit easier. So Judge Ashworth makes that decision. Eric at the time was concerned about it, but another judge, the new judge that came in, the Republican, Judge Ashworth had been a Democrat, as you mentioned. Judge Tigrid, who was the Republican, took over, and all of a sudden things started to change a little bit in the legal community in Kaufman. Judge Tigrid started paying the contract attorneys who are working for the state more. And and Eric was one of those. And Eric had decided a little while earlier to specialize in CPS cases, to do family law. And he soon kind of carved out a niche for himself where he was the CPS attorney who was appointed as a guardian ad litem cases in the county. Judge Tigrid gave him a lot of assignments. It was before long, Eric had real stature in the community as the CPS ad litem.
You talk about, too, that the Tigrid, the new judge, also increased the amount of money that he was paying to these people. So he actually didn't do worse after Ashworth retired. He actually did better.
He did significantly better.
Yes. And you say that Ashworth was a visiting judge and visited courthouses. And one day there was an incident with Eric, again, the person that he had helped and had befriended and treated just like almost like a son. Tell us about this little incident.
Well, Judge Ashworth walked into the lunchroom at the courthouse and saw Eric sitting at a table and went over to talk to his friend. And what he saw was Eric surrounded by paperwork from the county, and they were blank forms for him to fill out the hours that he spent on his CPS work as a guardian ad litem for these cases. that he was appointed to. And Judge Ashworth was troubled when he saw that they had already been signed by Judge Tigret. So Eric was filling in his time, putting down whatever he wanted without oversight. The judge said something to him about that he shouldn't be doing that. And that night, Eric sent him an email and chastised him for criticizing him and said that they couldn't be friends anymore. Judge Ashworth responded and said, well, I'm sorry you feel that way. I'll always think of you as a friend. And then Eric responded and said something on the order of, let's just forget about this. And the two men went out to lunch and everything continued on as if nothing had happened. But at home at the house, Kim noticed that Eric talked differently about Judge Ashworth, where before he'd always been proud of, his allegiance with the judge and talked about what a great man he was. All of a sudden, Eric started saying he was prissy and complaining about him. And this kind of animosity was building up within Eric against Judge Ashworth.
You also talk about a woman, Sandra Howard, that worked with him. And by 2005, she had some disturbing emails from him. Again, you talked about his shift in how he spoke about Judge Ashworth. What was his attitude in these emails to her? What was conveyed?
Well, Eric was becoming a powerful person in this little town of Kaufman and in Kaufman County. He was wielding a substantial amount of influence over these cases. And he started sending emails. Sandra represented the state. Eric was representing the children as a guardian ad litem. And then there were attorneys for the parents or for the relatives. And the most of them defense attorneys in the area. And Eric started sending out these strange emails at night in which he called the defense attorneys horrible names and talked about doing terrible things to them. And in one case, actually, threatened the defense attorney's family. Sandra didn't believe that Eric would do it. She didn't believe any of it was serious. She kind of saw it as, you know, the people in the courthouse did when he talked about, if I go out, I'm going to take other people with me. She kind of took it as Eric just spouting off, letting off steam. Later, of course, they'd look at that very differently.
Absolutely. Now, you chronicle the first time that Eric meets Michael McClellan. So tell us who this Michael McClellan is, just a little bit of his background. And even from the start, you say that they clash. So tell us why, and tell us a little bit first about Michael McClellan.
Mike McClellan grew up in that part of Texas. He grew up kind of in central Texas near Dallas. And he was a military guy. He'd been a major. He was a retired major from the U.S. Army. He'd served time, and he'd been over in Germany and then had been in the reserves and, you know, had retired out. And he'd gone back to school and become a lawyer. And he signed on with the same agency that Sandra Howard worked with. And so he was representing the state of Texas in these CPS cases. Well, Mike was the real thing. He was a soldier. He'd been a major. And Eric had always wanted to be what Mike was. And you would have thought maybe that would have been a bond between the two men. But from the beginning, there was just bad blood there. They brushed each other the wrong way. You know, Dan, it's like walking in, meeting somebody for the first time, and for some reason you can't stand that person. Well, that's what the two of them were like. Mike saw Eric as a wannabe soldier, as somebody who was pretending to be what he wasn't. He was a, you know, would-be soldier who never got in the Army. He was a wannabe cop who couldn't work, you know, who'd been fired by law enforcement and was a volunteer soldier with the sheriff's department, and he couldn't abide Eric Williams. And around Eric, Mike kept talking about his military experience as if he was kind of showing off a little bit. And before long, Sandra said it was like tying two cats together with a rope and throwing them over a clothesline. They were at each other, hissing and just posturing whenever they got together. Sandra didn't like working cases with the two of them because it was just so uncomfortable being around both of them.
How does Mike McClelland tell us a little bit briefly about how he gets to the point where these people are working and competing and at odds with each other again?
Well, Mike had always wanted to go into criminal law but had no history in it. He actually had a master's in psychology and had worked as a counselor and had done a lot of mental health law before he worked for CPS. But he decided to run for the DA slot in Kaufman County. And he and his wife, Cynthia, who is a nurse, a mental health nurse at the state hospital there, funny, kind woman who used to break into song at the drop of a hat. They went out campaigning and they worked really hard and Mike's family helped. He was a real underdog, but he got into the runoff and it looked like maybe he'd have a shot at the DA's office. People would say, well, he doesn't have the experience, and he didn't. He was running against a guy who was a seasoned Dallas County prosecutor. But Mike maintained that he didn't need experience, that the DA was a figurehead, that he ran an office, that he was a manager, and that he could do that, that he had this military experience and it would work. But Eric, who didn't like Mike, Eric, who did like the guy Mike was running against, ran an ad in the local newspaper questioning Mike's character and making kind of a veiled comment about ask him why he left the state of Texas, where he was working with Sandra Harwood. Well, Mike had left under rather a cloud because Mike was doing something he wasn't supposed to do at the time. He was taking court appointment cases in other counties, which was frowned upon by the state.
Right.
Mike lost the election. I think it was by about 65 votes, which isn't a lot. And that letter that ran in the paper, that could have cost him the election. So at that point, if there'd been animosity between Mike McClelland and Eric Williams, there was just flat-out bad blood.
Absolutely. So you talk about how he doesn't give up, and so what happens in the ensuing time for Eric? And what happens in the ensuing time for Mike McClelland?
Well, the next election comes around and 4 years later, and they're both running for office. This time, Mike is back running for the DA's slot again against the incumbent, the guy who defeated him the first time around. And
right.
Eric has decided to run for a slot as Justice of the Peace. There was a guy named Johnny Perry, and as Justice of the Peace, he was the lone Democrat in office in Kaufman County because, as we said earlier, the county had turned Republican.
Right.
And Eric decided to go ahead and throw his hat in. He thought that Perry had been in that office for like 20 years, but Eric thought that he was beatable. So they were both on the ballot that year. And it was a hard fought, but they both won. So as that year started, I think it's 2011, Mike McClelland comes in as 2011. Is that right, Dan? I haven't got the timetable right in front of me.
Yes, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. Eric comes in as the new Justice of the Peace in Kaufman County, and Mike McClelland is the new District Attorney.
Now, with Eric's role as Justice of the Peace, it's very similar to a judgeship, or at least he believes it's a pathship to judgeship like Judge Ashworth. Tell us about those powers and what is Eric's behavior before we get to what happens shortly after.
Well, You know, Eric had always been one of those guys who didn't like to ask permission to do things. And he got into the Justice of the Peace office and started to change things right away. His duties were to preside over a courtroom. It's kind of like a junior judge. They handle small cases, misdemeanors. They do traffic court. They have all kinds of different cases. They don't do the big cases. But he was handling the small cases. In rural Texas, where there aren't coroners in counties, they go out on death investigations and rule whether or not there be an autopsy. They perform weddings and often make quite a bit of additional money, performing weddings. That money is money they make on the side. But Eric did have that rebellious stint, and he started doing things on his own for the office, much of which were good. He put up a mailbox outside to get separate mail for the Justice of the Peace office because he thought it worked better. He installed a safe in the closet, bought it with his own money, put it in. He had already done some other things with the county computers where he had tried to update them on his own without getting permission. He'd had his hand slapped by the IT department, but he did it. Once he got in the JP's office, he started talking a lot about putting in a video magistration system. Eric Williams loved technology. He loved computers. He was always on the cutting edge. He wanted Kaufman County to be there, too. He didn't want to have to go down to the jail to read people their rights. He wanted to be able to do it over a Skype type of hookup, which a lot of the other counties in Texas were already doing. Kaufman County is a rural, slow-moving county. They'd been talking about this for a long time, hadn't gotten anything done. Eric, at a certain point, started to get frustrated. He wanted the changes. He brought a couple of the judges, the other justices at the peace, in to his office, showed them how it could work. They all liked it, but it had to go through committee. It had to go through the IT department, and Eric wasn't very patient.
You talk about these video monitors and some of the things that he wanted for this and him going, not getting requests filed. Tell us what he does and how do they find out what he has done?
Well, Eric didn't want to wait for that hookup to go through, and he started kind of nosing around in the IT department. The office was in the same building that his Justice of the Peace Court was in. So during off hours, especially on Sundays, he started popping over and looking through the IT department. One Friday, there was a woman named Lori Freimel who was working there, and she had a pile of monitors next to her desk. There were about six of them, and she had her computer up on them working on it. She left for the weekend, got back on Monday morning, and three of those monitors were gone. They were brand new Dell monitors. They each cost around $180. They were just gone. So she called around, tried to find out if somebody had taken them to deliver them to the sheriff's department. That's where they were going. That's what they were bought for the 911 system. No one knew what had happened to them. She pulled the videotape for the surveillance and was shocked to see Eric Williams walking out of the IT department and through the courthouse the Sunday before, the day before, carrying the boxes of Dell computers. He had taken them. He wanted them for his video magistration system. The next day, she walks in and she sees one of them on Eric's desk. By then, the county sheriff is becoming involved.
And you talk about this Chief Deputy Rodney Evans questioning Eric. What else did they see on that videotape that struck them as very unusual and disturbing?
Well, the videotape was troubling. Eric was holding a little radio, like a shortwave radio, as if he was monitoring calls to the sheriff's department. You know, it was one thing that he had taken the computers, but then he didn't say to Lori on Monday, "Hey, I took three computers. I'm trying them out for the video magistration system." And they found one of the computer boxes out in the dumpster behind the courthouse. It was just odd the way Eric had done all of this. So Evans, they start investigating, and they put up a – they get more evidence that Eric is going into the IT department the following Sunday. They see him leaving with something else. And they show up at the JP's office with a warrant for Eric's arrest for the theft of the three monitors. They take him down to the courthouse, and Evans starts interrogating him. And Eric says, yeah, I took the monitors, but one of them's in my office and the other one's in my car. He claimed that he had returned the third one. And he says they're for the video magistration system. And Evans says, well, you didn't have permission to take those, and we don't have the third monitor back. So Eric is booked and charged with the theft of property.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, Catherine Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the leading meal kit delivery service in the U.S., and while many people know what they do, many don't know about the types of meals you eat when you cook with Blue Apron, like strip steaks with potatoes and spicy maple collard greens, a steakhouse-inspired favorite with a delicious twist, chili-infused maple syrup. With incredible ingredients and chef-designed recipes, Blue Apron lets you see what the power of food can do. Blue Apron delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes right to your door that can be cooked in under 45 minutes. The menu changes every week based on what's in season and is designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team. Blue Apron offers 12 new recipes each week, and customers can pick 2, 3, or 4 recipes based on what best fits their schedule. Blue Apron sends only non-GMO ingredients and meat with no added hormones. Now, I tried just lately spiced tomato and coconut chicken with garlic rice. Fantastic. Love the combination of flavors and spices. And the end result, I cooked, again, I mentioned gourmet cooking done by me. And I also tried the Middle Eastern chicken and chickpea salad with brown rice and tahini dressing. Again, fantastic taste. I loved it, and I did it myself really easily. Now, gourmet recipes cooked to perfection by me. And now, Blue Apron is treating True Murder listeners to $30 off your first order if you visit blueapron.com/murder. So check out this week's menu and get your $30 off at blueapron.com/murder. And Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, Catherine, we spoke of Eric being arrested for equivalent of $600 worth of monitors, given that he had all this power, all this importance, and the powerful friends that he had, and the incredible background that he seemed to have. What does Eric think is going to happen as a result, and what does happen as this progresses?
Well, Eric, in the beginning, tried to work something out with the DA's office. You know, and they did make an offer to him. They offered to allow him to plead to a misdemeanor. But the misdemeanor included a theft charge, and Eric believed that he would lose his law license. So he decided to go ahead and fight it. He decided he wanted to go to court. His attorneys wanted to have the case moved out of Kaufman County, but Eric said, hey, you know, these people just elected me justice of the peace. I'm well-liked here. I have a lot of friends here. I'll be okay. Let's do it here. And Mike McClellan wasn't about to walk back. I mean, here he had Eric Williams, who'd been this thorn in his side since he got to Kaufman County, didn't like the guy at all. And, you know, he decided to pursue it. So he brought in a guy named Mark Hassey, who was one of his chief prosecutors in the office. He'd once been a really good prosecutor in Dallas County, and they pursued the case. They took it to court. A lot of the people in Kaufman County, especially in the law community, were really unhappy with this. They didn't like that the sheriff's department showed up in Eric's office, handcuffed him, and walked him out. They didn't like that everything Eric held dear, you know, his justice of the peace, his judgeship, his law license, everything was hanging in the balance over $600 worth of computers, especially when, or computer monitors, especially when one of the monitors was found in his desk and the other one was out in his car in the county parking lot. He was planning to take it to the jail. So they were upset over it. This really tore the county apart, especially the legal community. But Mike McClellan was bound and determined that Eric Williams was going to pay for what he did.
We did not mention, and this is a very important part of this story, is the importance of the Texas State Guard for Eric and for this case. So let's go just a little bit backwards and talk about his the importance to Eric of the Texas State Guard.
Eric, once he left military, after he was diagnosed with diabetes, and really felt kind of at a loss. So he joined what's called the Texas State Guard. It's kind of a state militia. And they do all kinds of things during, they handle like security at parades, at big events. They go in when there's been a hurricane here on the Gulf Coast where I live, and they help people out. They bring in water and food and things like that. And Eric loved it, and he was moving up the ranks. And he'd actually gotten a promotion shortly before this happened. I think he was a captain at that point when he was arrested, and he was living and breathing the guard. He used to he had a Segway. Eric had one of those little, you know, vehicles, personal vehicles that people ride on. And okay,
sure.
He had one. He used to go through the neighborhood in his state guard uniform with an AR weapon strapped to his back and circulate around it at night patrolling the neighborhood. I mean, he had really gotten into this. So, and he'd worked his way up. He worked really hard at it. Well, when he got arrested on the charges, the theft charges, he was forced to step down from that as well. He was suspended from the guard. So Eric was really looking at losing pretty much everything that was important to him if he lost this case. Mm-hmm.
You also mentioned, too, just to add to this, that Mike McClellan personally mailed the video of the guards to this Austin headquarters to make sure that he was removed from State Guard, wasn't he?
You know, I think there's no question that this was personal for Mike McClellan, and certainly that was one of the things that he didn't have to do that he did. He personally mailed that to the State Guard.
You talk about his behavior afterwards in terms of his substantial arsenal. What happened in terms of that substantial arsenal? Did it increase?
Well, all along it had been increasing. Kim said she didn't know how many guns Eric had, but there were guns all over the house. There were the guns at the office. And after Eric lost the case, after he was convicted on the theft charge, much to his surprise, he was told he was going to have to get rid of the guns. Felons in Texas, and I think most states, aren't allowed to have firearms. So he was told that the case went, the theft case was on appeal, but he was told he was going to have to get rid of the guns. He told the sheriff that he was doing that, but in truth, he had no intention of getting rid of the guns.
You talk about, too, that there was so much controversy with this that Taryn Davis, his attorney, withdrew from the case, and then Eric asked a friend from the guard named John Sickle, and they had to get another person as a second chair, David Sergey, a colonel in the guard. Tell us how things proceed with this court case.
Well, they went to court with it. And Mark Hassie's was a really good prosecutor. He was trained in Dallas during the, you know, I mean, he handled mob cases, he handled murders and drug cases. He didn't want to handle this case. He said from the beginning that he thought it was too personal. He wanted them to bring in a special prosecutor to do it, but Mike didn't want to. Mike second chaired it. He sat right next to Mark during the theft case. And they brought in their evidence and, you know, tried to prove that Eric had done this, that he had taken this, appealed to the jury as citizens of Kaufman County, saying he's stealing from you, that man's a thief. At one point, Mark Hassie pointed at Eric Williams and said, you know, he's a thief, look at him, that's what he is. It got pretty nasty in that courtroom, Dan, and Eric was convicted on the case, and the case did go into an appeal, and in the meantime, Eric lost everything. It had been a gamble. He was put on probation, 2 years probation, but he lost his law license taken away. He lost the JP position, which meant that he was also looking at losing his insurance, his health insurance.
Right.
And he had a sick wife with rheumatoid arthritis, and he was a type 1 diabetic. This was a problem. He was no longer a member of the National or the State Guard, something he was really proud of. Eric Williams lost his life over basically $600 worth of computer monitors, two of which were on county property.
Now, Mike and Mark Hassie, what kind of relationship did they have? And even after this conviction, you say that they continued. So what was that continuance of? What did they do, and what did they say?
Well, you know, there was this animosity in the law community in Kaufman County over this case. A lot of people were upset about the way this case had been handled. So they were spending a lot of time trying to appeal to the attorneys in the area, showing them things like that surveillance tape, saying, look, the guy's a thief. Look what he did. And, you know, Mike didn't have the background that he probably needed to be the district attorney in Kaufman County. Mark did, but Mark wasn't in a position to tell Mike what to do. Mike was his boss. So Mark backed him up, did what Mike told him to do, and, you know, the result was that Eric lost his life, basically everything. All, you know, he had no way to support himself. He had a sick wife. He had no insurance. He'd lost everything. So Mike and Mark were really good friends. They went out to lunch often together. You know, this is really, it's kind of like I said earlier, small-town courthouses are kind of incubators. And this was festering in that courthouse in Kaufman County.
Now, after this conviction, what was the response in terms of how close he lived to the courthouse and that former access he had to the courthouse and this arsenal of weapons that everybody knew about?
Well, everybody knew about these weapons, and they were worried about the weapons, but and one day Eric showed up at the courthouse. Remember, his office is right across the street from the downtown courthouse. And they stop him coming in and they search him. So where before he'd had his own pass key, which was unusual for lawyers, to get into the courthouse, now he was so untrustworthy, so worried about that he was being treated differently when he walked in the door. The Justice of the Peace office that he worked in was right across the field from his office in a different direction than Judge Ashworth's house. They kind of made a triangle. And when in the winter, when the leaves were off the trees, you could actually see the courthouse building from Eric's backyard. So it was just really close quarters. Another thing that happened, and I think you were talking about this earlier, Dan, I didn't pick up on it, was that throughout this time, Mike and Mark were making disparaging remarks about Eric to Eric's friends at the courthouse. They were voicing their opinion of who Eric Williams was. They found out about the Janice Gray incident in Huntsville, the one where he had shown the woman the gun and said, I have nothing to lose. So they thought, perhaps rightly, that Eric was kind of, as we'd say in Texas, locked and loaded, that he was kind of on the edge. And they started to worry about Eric. They did throughout this. They were worried about Eric. Mike, with his experience as a psychologist, thought that Eric was dangerous, that that he could go over the edge and over the top. And Mark was very worried about Eric Williams. He told a lot of friends that of all the cases he'd handled, and he'd had major criminals he prosecuted, this was the guy that scared him.
You also talk about Mark talking about running for Eric's judgeship or justice of the peace, which couldn't have made him anything more than just more angry than he was.
You know, Eric didn't know that Mark was looking at doing that. That was something that Mark talked about with some of the people in his office. But it certainly raises the question of, you know, did Mark, like Mike, have a personal reason to want to go after Eric Williams? It's not that Eric shouldn't have been punished for what he did.
Sure.
You know, it's the extent to which he was punished. A lot of people in Kaufman knew that he wanted to build that computer system, and that Eric had a history of trying to do things on his own without going through channels. So when you look at his intentions on this, it kind of raises the question of how personal was all of this. And Mark, very wisely, he was a good prosecutor, he knew what he was doing, he very wisely thought he should not be the one to prosecute that case and that Mike shouldn't, and that somebody from the outside should be brought in to take a look at it. But Mike wouldn't have anything to do with that.
You talk about all the punishments that happened immediately and all the loss for him, including insurance and all the privilege, and his life is turned upside down. Yet at the same time, Mike McClellan still wanted and had asked for and still demanded jail time for these minor crimes.
Mike was determined that he'd run on a cleanup Kaufman County, you know, no favoritism in the courthouse platform. And he was determined that Eric Williams was going to pay to the full extent of the law for what he had done. And, yeah, he wanted jail time for Eric. The judge didn't agree. Eric put it in Judge Mike Cicci's hands, and he did not agree, and he came back and gave Eric probation. Mike was unhappy with that, and he told people he was unhappy with that. He saw Eric Williams as a thief, and he wanted him in prison.
Now, you say, meanwhile, Kim, married to Eric, is really livid about him losing his job, and she has the same blame for the people, the obvious blame for who had him lose his job. And you say they're at home playing video games called Mafia Wars, but you talk about that in November, there's another bit of things to worry about for Eric. And what is that in terms of something coming from Mike McClellan again?
Well, they found out while they were working on all of this that Eric was the head of the law library, which was a room that the attorneys were supposed to be able to use at the main courthouse, and that Eric had been ordering supplies for the library. The library had a big budget. It had like $200,000 in the bank out of a $10 fee on civil cases that went into the coffers, and that Eric had been having supplies that he ordered from the local office supply place delivered to his office, not to the law library. Well, that actually made sense because nobody was at the law library to sign for them. But some of the things raised questions, things like headphones, that they went up and looked at the law library, didn't find all of the things that Eric, as a matter of fact, found very few of the things that Eric had ordered through the office supply store for the law library, and they filed more charges against Eric for theft. This time, I think it was for up to $1,700 worth of misappropriation of office supplies from the county. And despite the fact that they had already taken away everything they could from Eric, the only thing that remained was jail time. They filed those charges, and those were hanging over Eric's head.
You also talk about a very disturbing thing that wouldn't help Eric whatsoever in terms of his mental attitude, is that his lawyer was speaking with the prosecution, and meanwhile she had her tape recorder on and recorded some of the things that they said about her client, and she transcribed those and sent copies to lawyers and to Eric. Again, just what is some of the things that they said or intimated in that conversation?
Well, that was with Mark Hassey, and he was calling Eric names, calling him a thief, saying he was dishonorable, just, and that they were going to go after him, and, you know, that the lawyer representing him, he felt sorry for him because he had such an unsympathetic client, things like that. But they, you know, Dan, they were saying things all over that courthouse, and it was getting back to Eric through Eric's friends. You know, the animosity was just building. It was just building.
So they talk about the court case itself, and to add even more complication to this, Mike McClellan is not supposed to be involved in this prosecution. Tell us how he does become involved with this.
Well, when he's another woman, a woman named Michelle, I'm sorry, I'm losing her last name right now. I think it's Sutton, but I'm not positive. Is that right? It was second. There are so many people in this book. I think I interviewed well over 100 people. Michelle was supposed to be second chair with Mark, but Michelle was diagnosed with breast cancer and stepped down. And rather than assigning somebody else in the office to work with Mark, Mike decided he wanted to do it. This was one of the first criminal cases Mike McClellan had ever he's the DA in this county, and he had, you know, a handful of criminal cases he'd worked over the years. It was his first in Kaufman County.
Now, with this, they also, you talk about meanwhile, what is Eric and Kim doing at home with all of this faced? What is their behavior, and what are they doing? And what is Eric researching and doing, and we soon find out, planning?
Well, he starts, even before the end of the theft trial, Eric is walking around the house talking about Mike and Mark. He had names for them. Oh, gosh, I'm drawing a blank now. I'm so sorry. Disparaging names for the two of them. He stopped calling them Mike and Mark and started using other terms for them. And he starts, they're playing on their computers all the time. As you said, they played Mafia Wars incessantly. And he also starts looking up. He's still able to log into the LexisNexis account through the courthouse, and he starts looking up personal information like addresses and information on car registration and things like that for Mike and Mark. And, you know, he's searching for information. And then he starts talking to Kim about his enemies list, the people he plans to get revenge against. And the list has names on it that are, at this point, not surprising. Judge Glenn Ashworth is on the list. Early Wiley, who is one of the judges at the courthouse and who'd been responsible for Eric losing some of his CPS work, was on the list. And, of course, high on the list were Mike and Mark. And the sheriff was on the list at that time. He was angry with the sheriff. He saw the sheriff as a friend and thought the sheriff should have protected him.
Now, what is the health of Kim at this time?
Well, Kim is getting sicker and sicker, and she's getting increasingly dependent on painkillers and pain medications. She starts out, she's taking things like Vicodin and opiates, and before long, she's needing Percodin. She's taking more and more of these things in order to just function. She's spending an increasingly large amount of her time in bed. Her parents live nearby. They've moved a block away. And when she's not in bed, she's over at her parents' house watching over them. They're elderly, and her father's dying of cancer. But most of Kim's time is spent in bed in kind of a haze, a drug-induced haze from her prescription medication.
You talk about this list that Sam Keats talked about. And where does that list go? What happens from that list? And finally, who's on the list?
Well, one day Sam Keats, who's a friend of Mike McClellan's, is in his office, and a secretary comes in with a faxed list, and it has five names on it. And she said this came over. It's a list that Eric Williams is supposed to have put together. And on it were the names of Judge Ashworth, Early Wiley, Mike, Mark, and a woman named Denise who runs a small newspaper in the Forney area, which is nearby. And Mike says, well, what am I supposed to do with this? Is this some kind of a hit list? And he looks at Sam, and they look at the names, and he folds up the list, and he puts it in his desk drawer, and then, but then afterward, he says, do you think I should tell these people? And Sam says, well, yeah, I think you should. And afterward, he does get in touch with Denise, the newspaper woman who's on the list, and says, Eric Williams got this list, and your name's on it. And if things start to go bad, run.
You talk about Ron Harrington after that, whenever he ran into Mark at the courthouse, he talked about Eric. Mark talked about Eric, and he said, what did he say about Eric to Ron Harrington?
He said that Eric was going to kill him, that he was afraid Eric was going to try to kill him. Mark started carrying a gun. Mark flew airplanes, and at the small airport where he flew his plane out of, people would see him working on his plane, he never did this before. He had a holster on with a handgun at his side. He wore one in the courthouse at all times, registered with the DA's office as a law enforcement officer so he could bring it into the courtroom with him. He was afraid. Mark was afraid. He moved his car. He used to park his car a block from the courthouse behind the dry cleaner. He'd done that since he started in Kaufman. All of a sudden, he was parking in the county lot, coming at different times, fluctuating his schedule. Mark Hasse was really afraid of Eric Williams.
You talk about Eric and Kim, and Eric talking to Kim in this drugged-out state that she was, sick and mostly in bed, but she shared his anger and listened to him. It's hard to say how seriously she took him, but he was talking about very serious things like assassinating some of these people. Now, when he talked about some of these things, what did he also include in terms of preparation to do these things? What else did they do together?
Well, he started talking more and more about killing Judge Ashworth. He was really angry with Judge Ashworth. He thought that Judge Ashworth had told Mike and Mark about the Janice Gray incident. Ashworth hadn't, but he thought that he had. So he started talking about different ways to kill the judge. He talked about buying a crossbow, going over to the judge's house, and then shooting him with a crossbow, bringing him back to the house, to Eric and Kim's house, pouring napalm, gutting him while he was alive, pouring napalm into his stomach to kill him, and burying him in the backyard. And Eric started digging up the rose bushes in the backyard, and Kim walked out and said, "What's that for?" And he said, "Well, I want to see if the judge's body will fit in here." Eric made napalm to do this, and one day Eric came home after shopping with Kim's father at a store, and he had bought the crossbow. But then he changed his mind, and he thought he'd go after Mark first. And Kim didn't want to go with him. Kim kept saying, "You know, I'm not going to do this." Now, she was angry at Mark and Mike. They had destroyed their lives as far as Kim was concerned. But she kept saying, "I'm not going to do this." And Eric's response was, "You have to. You're my wife." And Kim was afraid of Eric. She had reason to be afraid of him. So at one point, she drives him out to Mark's house out in the country. And they sit down at the end of the driveway and watch the cars coming and going. And Eric hatches a plot where he's going to shoot Mark as he leaves for the office in the morning through the glass window of his truck. And he thinks then that Mark's car will kind of careen off the road and hit a tree. And people will think he's been hit by a stray bullet.
This plan obviously changes, but we'll talk about part of this plan, too, is that he had some friends in this State Guard, Texas State Guard. In fact, they keep calling him Captain, so there's a lot of respect from these fellow State Guard members. And he calls a fellow Guard member named Roger Williams, no relation to him, but a man named Roger Williams. What does he ask him to do, and what does Roger agree to do?
Eric calls Roger Williams and says that Kim's brother is moving to the area and needs to put his stuff in storage. And the family's asked Eric to get a storage building for him to put in, a storage, like a garage kind of thing at a storage center. And Roger Williams agrees to go down and help Eric get it. The reason Eric says he can't do it on his own is that because of the theft conviction, that it could be searched at any time, and Eric doesn't want Kim's family to go through that embarrassment. So Roger Williams agrees to do this with Eric, goes to this storage area in Segoville, and they rent a unit. And after they rent this unit, it's kind of the size of a one-car garage. Roger offers to help Eric move Kim's brother's things in, and Eric says, "Oh, don't worry about it. I'll move it in. I'll take care of it, no problem." And, you know, Roger Williams drives off, assuming that that's what's going in that storage area, but that's not what Eric intends it for.
You're saying that Eric also logs onto the LexisNexis website account and searches for information about Mark, driver's license, and where Mike McClellan lived. You talk about bought a Mercury Sable, so they had a getaway car that wasn't their sport track, black truck. That he prepared by buying all kinds of assault and military equipment before, in preparation for this. Let's get to the day that Mark Hasse is assassinated.
Well, it's a cold morning in Dallas, outside of Dallas, in this old town, and Eric wakes Kim up that morning. She knows that it's the morning that they're going to do this. By then, she's agreed because he's threatened to kill her parents if she doesn't help. And they drive into downtown Kaufman, where they've left this getaway car, this Sable. And she drives him. They get in the stable, leave the sport track, Eric's car there, and they drive into town and they wait for Mark in the parking lot. Eric has had him under surveillance, obviously, because he knows that's where Mark's parking. And as Mark gets out of the car, out of his truck that morning, Eric gets out of the car, dressed all in black, wearing a hood with mesh in front of it over his face, and walks around and walks up to Mark. There are words between the two of them. Eric pushes, and then the shooting starts. Mark has a gun on, but he's got a coat on over it, and the coat's buttoned, and he can't get to it. And Mark's a smaller man, and Eric's pushing and shooting, and Eric takes the gun and shoots like at the base of Mark's neck, straight down into his body, and Mark falls. And by then, Eric has used up the five bullets in one handgun, pulls out another one, shoots some bullets into the air. They get into the car, and Kim drives Eric away.
Incredibly, there was a witness, somebody that knew Eric. Because of the situation, she thought there was a much taller, much heavier man. Eric is, of course, a natural suspect. Tell us how on earth he gets away with this crime.
You know, in investigations like this, sometimes chance plays an incredible role, and in this case, it certainly did. When Mike McClelland hears about this, the first thing he says is it's Eric Williams. He's standing over Mark's body at the hospital, and he tells the coroner, the justice of the peace, who's there looking at the body ordering the autopsy, that Eric Williams did this. He told everyone that Eric Williams had done this. But the problem was that at the same time he's saying this, there were things going on at Kaufman County involving the Aryan Brotherhood. And there had been threats made by the Aryan Brotherhood that had been reported by different law enforcement agencies, including the FBI and the Texas Department of Public Safety, warning people that the Aryan Brotherhood could be coming after people in law enforcement. So this whole situation unfolds where you have Mike McClelland telling anyone who will talk to him and a lot of other people in Kaufman County pointing the finger at Eric Williams. But the local police chief in Kaufman, Texas, who's the lead investigator on the case, he's in charge of the case, is sending the FBI, the Texas Rangers, and a lot of his resources off on a wild goose chase looking for evidence against the Aryan Brotherhood or the Mexican Mafia. The irony in this case is just overwhelming, Dan. I mean, you have, there were so many people talking about Eric Williams, and the people in law enforcement, because of the circumstances, and they do have to investigate all leads. It could have been the Aryan Brotherhood. But they're off investigating, spending most of their resources in investigating dead ends at the time.
You say, meanwhile, Eric Williams, Kim is still sick and wants to be oblivious to what's going on, but still a participant in and hearing about these plans, and he has plans for the next person on his list, not content to have gotten away, been so intelligent to have fooled all these law enforcement experts. At the same time, Mike McClelland puts an ADT security service in his home, and this is a man that has 100 weapons in his home and this military experience, and he still believes that Eric is the person responsible. Despite that, the police, FBI, profilers, and this increasingly big group of people are still chasing leads as the Aryan Brotherhood and also the Mexican cartel. tell us how long, what is going on, and what happens to Mike McClelland and his wife, Cynthia?
Well, this goes on for 2 months, where they're trying to figure out what happened in this case. The FBI arrives. The Texas Rangers are there. There are a lot of people working this case. But most of them, as I said, are off investigating the Aryan Brotherhood. Eric is has his lawyers from the theft case. They're a barrier against interviewing him. He's refusing to be interviewed. This wears on. The investigation wears on and wears on and wears on. And in the house on Overlook, Eric is saying to Kim, "We're going to do the next one. We've got the next one coming up." He starts talking about Mike and Cynthia. And she says, "Well, you know, what if Mike said, all right, so it goes, they have different scenarios again, like drive-by shootings and things that they talk about." And then Eric says that he's going to kill Mike at the house the day before Easter. And what he's seeing is that the investigation is kind of winding down. It's not that they've given up, but fewer people are working it. The command station, which is a block from Eric's house, has been vacated, and they've moved a smaller force into the sheriff's department. Easter Sunday, a lot of the detectives and a lot of the people will be with their families. They won't be working over the Easter holidays. So he sees this as his opportunity. So the next one on his list is Mike McClelland. So the Saturday before Easter, Holy Saturday, again, they get up early. Kim and Eric get up early. They go to the storage area. This time he's driving a Crown Victoria. He's dressed in full SWAT gear. And they drive out to the McClelland house. Kim, who's ill, is scrunched up against the door, not wanting to be there. Eric goes up to the front door, disappears inside. He's got an AR weapon with him. She hears the gunshots. He's in there a short period of time, just rat-a-tat-tat, and he less than 2 minutes later, he walks back out, puts his the AR weapon in the back seat of the car, and they drive off. And as he leaves, he said, "She opened the door for me," which is Cynthia, "and then went to get Mike, and I just started shooting."
Now, they had bought a Crown Victoria getaway car, the first car they got rid of, and again, chance plays a part in them being able to get away. We only have a couple minutes left in this interview, and we can't get into some of the more exciting things that go on afterwards. And you got to interview both of these, Eric and Kim, later. Maybe just in closing, you could tell us a little bit about those interviews.
You know, they were really pretty remarkable. Eric's on death row now, and I spent quite a bit of time with him. I think I interviewed him 5 times, and he insists that he didn't do it. He says that Kim is lying. Kim turned state's evidence. Eric got the death penalty. Kim got 40 years. Kim is repentant. Kim understands that they killed 3 people and what they did to these families. Eric still maintains his innocence. And I think he feels entitled to have done what he did based on, you know, what he believes Eric, what he believes Mike and Mark did to him.
It was an incredible trial as well, and we didn't have time to go through it whatsoever. There is so much incredible detail. The characterization is so visual, this book, and it's so exciting. You're at the edge of your seat through this entire thing, even though you know, just from the description of the book itself, you know what the outcome is. But this is a very exciting book. I want to thank you very much, Catherine, for coming on and talking about In Plain Sight, the Kaufman County Prosecutor's Murders. For those that might want to read about other work you've done, do you have a website or a Facebook page for this? How can people look at this information about this?
I do. I have both on Facebook. It's my name, Catherine Casey, K-A-T-H-R-Y-N-C-A-S-E-Y. And my website is CatherineCasey.com. And thank you so much, Dan. It's always such a pleasure to talk with you.
It is always a pleasure, and you've outdone yourself with this book. Incredible story and incredible writing. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about In Plain Sight. Hope to talk to you again.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Casey.
Bye.
Good night.